Taoiseach, First Minister in the Republic of Ireland, were both from the Sinn Féin party and both from a party that is committed to Irish unity. And that's going to create a very interesting situation in the north, because that, if you like, very clearly foreshadows or prefigures a united Ireland. And because that alarms unionists in the north to the same extent as it pleases nationalists in the north. Which is not to say, and Ireland's a complicated place, as you know. As the more the tide towards the united Ireland increases, the more alarmed the unionists will become. And connected to that is the fact that there has emerged in the last election, and this too is historic, there has emerged a centre ground, if you like, represented by the Alliance Party, which radicals like myself would regard as a conservative, a middle-class party. Nevertheless, it is neither orange nor green. It is not unionist or nationalist. And you have got to now, you know, a significant section of the representatives in Stormont who do not designate themselves orange or green, nationalist or unionist or nationalist. And that's a new factor. And the reason, if I could just finish on this, that it's a new factor, is that the constitution in Northern Ireland, the arrangement set up under the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, doesn't allow for three separate designations at Stormont. I mean, it is built upon the Good Friday Agreement, is built upon the notion, really, the implicit notion that everybody in Northern Ireland can be allocated to either the Green Party or the Orange Party. And then the task is, and this is what the Good Friday Agreement was about, to find a way in which the Green side and the Orange side can live together and share power. The implications of another bloc in the middle, neither orange nor green, emerging, and I think that really is in the process of emerging, are uncharted. This was never planned for. And so it's going to be interesting to watch that, and none of us knows how it's going to work out.
I also wanted to go to former president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, leading a vigil last week in West Belfast, marking the 41st year since the death of Bobby Sands, May 5th, 1981, while on hunger strike at the Mays prison.
Very impressive white line picket to mark the anniversary of the death of Bobby Sands 41 years ago. So those of us who were active in those days will remember with sadness and huge pride Bobby and the other hunger strikers.
And that's former Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams standing with others leading a vigil holding Bobby Sands' picture. How Bobby Sands' death and the hunger strikes and the IRA link to the victory today for Sinn Féin, Eamon?
Yes, well, it's a long time since Bobby Sands died, of course. And Bobby Sands died in pursuit of the united Ireland. He gave his life literally, I mean, to bring about a united Ireland. And there can be a discussion today in 2022, and indeed there is a discussion, as to whether the settlement which has been reached under the Good Friday Agreement, whether that represents an adequate return on the pain, sort of invested, if you like, by Republicans and by the nationalist community generally in Northern Ireland. Is the settlement which is now being put in place and which is operating, is that a fair enough return? And that's a question, of course, which you can't answer yes or no, or certainly we can't answer it yes or no as yet. So again, sort of there's, when we talk about, there's a very fluid situation in Ireland, and particularly in Northern Ireland, and it would be foolish to analyse it in terms of, you know, static positions for and against unification or for and against retaining Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. In the cliche,
we have 5 seconds, Eamon.
Okay, Alicia, it's still all to be played for. Whether we get a final settlement, that was very dubious. Northern Ireland defies logic. And so nobody knows. Literally, I don't know. Nobody else knows how this thing is going to work out.
We'll leave it there, Eamon McCann, journalist, 1974 book just republished, War in an Irish Town, by Reid Farrell, Sinn Féin lawmaker in the Irish Parliament. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have the most important question facing us. What can be done against the crimes of aggression and other international war crimes that we see unfolding before our eyes right now? We have Marjorie Cohen to speak with us. Marjorie, what are you going to talk about?
Michael, I'm going to talk about the possible commission of the crime of aggression, war crimes, and crimes against humanity by Russia and in some instances by Ukraine, and whether or not the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction to prosecute those crimes.
We take a look at the use of the necessity defense to curb and control climate change.
We speak with attorney Ted Hamilton, who's recently had published his book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts, and the Fight for a Sustainable Future.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution that, quote, encourages member states to petition the International Criminal Court or other appropriate international tribunals to take any appropriate steps to investigate war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by the Russian armed forces, close quote. Yet the United States has consistently undermined the ICC. The U.S. government thinks the ICC is reliable enough to try Russians, but not U.S. or Israeli officials. Today on Law and Disorder, we will examine the matter of what constitutes a war crime, whether war crimes have been committed by either side in Russia and the Ukraine, and the role of the International Criminal Court in adjudicating whether or not war crimes have in fact been committed. Our guest today is co-host on Law and Disorder, Marjorie Cohn, who is a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's a member of the Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace and the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie Cohn writes a regular column on Truthout and provides frequent legal and political commentary for local, national, and international media. Her books include Drones and the Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder, and this time on the side of a guest. Thank you for being here, Marjorie. Charges against Russia for its conduct of the war in the Ukraine. Before we get into the matter of what war crimes may actually have been committed in the Ukraine, is the United States a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court?
The answer is no. As Bill Clinton was leaving office, he put the U.S. signature on the Rome Statute for the ICC. Now, the difference between signing and ratifying a treaty is that when a country signs a treaty, that indicates an intent to ratify. Once two-thirds of the Senate in the United States give its advice and consent to ratification, then the president ratifies a treaty and then the U.S. becomes a party to that treaty. Now, as Clinton was leaving office, he advised the incoming President George W. Bush not to send the Rome Statute to the Senate for advice and consent to ratification. So Bush enters office, and not only did he refrain from sending the Rome Statute to the Senate, he unsigned the Rome Statute. It was unprecedented, actually removed the U.S. signature from the Rome Statute. So the answer once again is no, the U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court.
Professor Cohn, you recently wrote an article on truthdig.org entitled, "After Undermining International Criminal Court, U.S. Now Wants It to Charge Russians." In what ways has the United States tried to undermine the ICC over the years?
Well, shortly after Bush unsigned the Rome Statute, Congress passed what was called the American Service Members Protection Act, which contains a clause called the Hague Invasion Act. And it says that if a U.S. or allied national is detained by the ICC, the U.S. military can use armed force to extricate them. Now, although the U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute, it has nevertheless tried to influence the direction of the court. And the Bush administration effectively blackmailed 100 countries, developing democracies with weak economies, 100 countries that were parties to the Rome Statute, by forcing them to sign bilateral immunity agreements in which they promised not to turn over U.S. persons to the ICC or, and this is the blackmail, the United States would withhold foreign aid from them. In 2020, the ICC launched an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity by the United States as well as Taliban leaders in Afghanistan. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on ICC officials, which Biden later reversed. But when a new chief prosecutor came into the ICC, he narrowed the scope of the Afghanistan investigation by limiting suspects to Taliban and ISIS leaders, citing limited resources. But this was clearly a political decision. And there are victims of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan who will now not receive justice from the ICC. Torture by the CIA in the brutal Bagram prison, and civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan. And Biden has expressed serious concerns about the ICC's attempts to exercise its jurisdiction over Israeli personnel. So the ICC is good enough to try Russians, but not U.S. or Israeli leaders. Well, back to the Israeli investigation into Israeli war crimes and Palestinian war crimes as well, but primarily Israeli war crimes in the ICC. After a 5-year preliminary examination, the former ICC chief prosecutor found a reasonable basis to mount an investigation of the situation in Palestine, and she was satisfied that war crimes were being committed in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. And she initiated her preliminary examination 6 months after Israel's 2014 so-called Operation Protective Edge, in which Israeli military forces killed 2,200 Palestinians, nearly one quarter of them children, and more than 80% civilians. And Michael, there is incredible U.S. hypocrisy in this resolution that was unanimously passed by the Senate. And you know, senators can't agree on anything these days, but all 100 senators agreed to the resolution trying to get the ICC to try Russians for war crimes. And in the second paragraph of that resolution, it says, and I quote, "Whereas the United States of America is a beacon for the values of freedom, democracy, and human rights across the globe, ... This, Michael, in spite of the U.S. wars of aggression in Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries, and the commission of U.S. war crimes, many of which were revealed by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in 2010, which is why Julian Assange is now facing 175 years in prison if he's extradited from the U.K. But if these U.S. senators truly believed that the ICC is dependable enough to prosecute Russian leaders, they should push Biden to send the Rome Statute to them for advice and consent to ratification, because what's good for the Russian goose should also be good for the U.S. gander.
Amen. Hypocrisy really is not a strong enough word here, Marjorie. Before we look at what acts during the war in Ukraine could be considered war crimes, cannot the very act of invading another country and waging war there itself be considered a crime? Could the ICC punish Russian leaders for the crime of aggression?
Well, in 1946, the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg called the waging of aggressive war essentially an evil thing. And they said to initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who took a leave from the court to serve as chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg Tribunal, called aggressive war the greatest menace of our times. And Jackson said, if certain acts in violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. Aggression is prohibited by the ICC's Rome Statute. The crime of aggression is defined as the planning, preparation, initiation, or execution by a person in a position effectively to exercise control over or to direct the political or military action of a state of an act of aggression which, by its character, gravity, and scale, constitutes a manifest violation of the Charter of the United Nations. Now, adopting the central prohibition of the UN Charter against the use of aggressive force, the Rome Statute defines an act of aggression as the use of armed force by a state against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of another state, or in any other manner inconsistent with the Charter of the United Nations. The UN Charter only allows the use of military force when conducted in self-defense after an armed attack or with the consent of the Security Council, neither of which happened before Russia invaded Ukraine. Now, the jurisdictional scheme for the ICC, and by the way, the ICC, the Rome Statute, punishes for the four most atrocious crimes in the world, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. And the original Rome Statute said that genocide, war crimes, and crimes of aggression could be prosecuted in the ICC if, number one, the defendant's country was a party to the Rome Statute, or number two, one or more elements of the crime was committed in the territory of a state that's a party to the Rome Statute, or three, the defendant's country accepted ICC jurisdiction for the matter, or four, upon referral by the UN Security Council. But the Rome Statute left the definition and jurisdictional scheme for prosecuting the crime of aggression to the future. And finally, there was an agreement to prosecute the crime of aggression, and I just read you the definition of the crime of aggression, which is contained in amendments to the Rome Statute. But the way it's been interpreted is that in order to come under the jurisdiction of the ICC for a crime of aggression, a leader, in this case we're talking a Russian leader, the country of Russia would have to actually adopt, or Ukraine would have to actually adopt these amendments defining aggression, and neither Russia nor Ukraine has done that. Now, Ukraine has accepted jurisdiction of the ICC for purposes of war crimes and crimes against humanity, but has not ratified these aggression amendments. So that's the long answer to your question. The short answer is that the ICC does punish the crime of aggression, but no, it cannot punish Russian leaders for the crime of aggression, although it could punish them and Ukrainians as well for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
We're talking with our own Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita of law at Thomas Jefferson University in San Diego. Marjorie, of all the people that we might have had, we have you as our co-host, who actually knows quite a lot about this. So we're so pleased to have you on Law and Disorder. Marjorie, could you please outline for us any acts committed by Russia and or Ukraine that may constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity?
Yes, Michael. First, I want to say that Karim Khan, who's the chief prosecutor of the ICC, opened an investigation into the situation in Ukraine, and his preliminary examination found a reasonable basis to believe that alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity had been committed in Ukraine, and he said his investigation will encompass any new alleged crimes that are committed by any party to the conflict. That includes Ukrainian leaders as well. And on the 22nd of April, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said that there were accusations of war crimes against both sides, and that they had verified 5,264 civilian casualties, including 2,345 deaths since the war began on February 24th. And 92.3% of them were recorded in Ukrainian government-controlled territory. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Office said in a statement, and I quote, "Russian armed forces have indiscriminately shelled and bombed populated areas, killing civilians and wrecking hospitals, schools, and other civilian infrastructure, actions that may amount to war crimes." And they also said that they documented what appears to be the use of weapons with indiscriminate effects, causing civilian casualties and damage to civilian objects by Ukrainian armed forces in the east of the country. There have also been extensive reports that some women were raped before being killed by Russian forces. And once again, rape constitutes torture, which constitutes a war crime. In terms of the environmental war crime, Russia's seizure of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster site mobilized radioactive dust and increased detectable radiation that could spread radioactive material into new areas. And attacks against some cities caused major fires in fuel storage areas, threatening serious air, ground, and water pollution. Now, in terms of crimes against humanity, which are defined as taking place in the context of a large-scale attack targeting civilians, crimes against humanity include torture, persecution of an identifiable group, and other inhumane acts, intentionally causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health. The New York Times reported on April the 19th that the Ukrainian government was using cluster bombs, which is a class of weapons that include rockets, bombs, missiles, mortar, and artillery shells that split open midair and dispense smaller bomblets over a wide area. And sometimes they don't explode, so children and other people can step on them and then they explode and kill or maim them. The Convention on Cluster Munitions bans them because of the indiscriminate harm that they can cause for civilians. Now, neither the U.S., Ukraine, nor Russia have signed that convention, but nevertheless, it is possible that the use of cluster bombs could constitute a crime against humanity.
Does the ICC have the power or the authority to arrest alleged war criminals? And how effective has the ICC been in prosecuting accused war criminals? And how long does the process take from when the charges are brought to the conclusion of the case?
The answer is yes, the ICC does have the power to arrest alleged war criminals. Now, they have to first find them and get jurisdiction over them, and that is not an easy feat. The ICC has primarily prosecuted leaders of African countries, and it has come under criticism for that. Although, as I said, there is a formal investigation now pending in the ICC against now Taliban and ISIS leaders for crimes in Afghanistan, as well as Israeli leaders, as well as Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. Since 2002, when the Rome Statute became effective, there have been only 10 convictions, and again, mostly African leaders. And the process is a very long one. It takes years from the initial preliminary examination to the formal investigation, to subpoenas, arrests, trial, and ultimately sentencing.
Led by the USA and other NATO nations, the Western world has imposed on Russia what many believe to be the harshest set of sanctions ever imposed on a country. But are sanctions lawful?
Well, Michael, the United States has also imposed sanctions on Cuba since 1959-1960, an embargo which has now become a blockade, which has put tremendous economic and political pressure on Cuba and Cubans and punishes other countries for trading with Cuba. The U.S. has imposed punishing sanctions on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and a number of other countries. And the United States and other NATO countries have indeed imposed grueling sanctions against Russia, most of which actually harm the Russian people, and not just the Russian people, but people around the world, including people in the United States. And we can see that reflected in the very high gas prices we find when we go to the pump. Now, the answer to your question is no, sanctions are not lawful. They are unilateral coercive measures, and they violate the UN Charter because under the Charter, only the UN Security Council has the authority to order the use of sanctions. And that means that the United States and other countries cannot unilaterally impose sanctions against other countries without the approval of the Security Council. Article 41 of the UN Charter says the Security Council may decide what measures not involving the use of armed force are to be employed to give effect to its decisions, and it may call upon the members of the United Nations to apply such measures. These may include complete or partial interruption of economic relations and of rail, sea, air, postal, telegraphic, radio, and other means of communication, and the severance of diplomatic relations. So, whereas the corporate media is rife with reports about sanctions, you know, screaming for harsher sanctions against Russia, these unilateral coercive measures imposed against Russia by the United States and other NATO countries violate the UN Charter.
Marjorie Cohen, we only have a few more minutes till we run out of our allotted time, unfortunately. But before I ask you a final question, can you tell us where listeners can read your frequent online posts? And do you have a website you'd like to refer our listeners to?
Yes, I write a regular column on truthout.org, and my column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. That comes out three or four times a month. And all of my articles, videos, interviews, radio interviews, books, etc. are collected at my website, which is marjoriecohen.com.
Marjorie, final question. I read in the New York Times that Biden has pledged to give another $34 billion in arms to the Ukraine. It really is a proxy war. We can understand the circumstances which drove Russia to invade the Ukraine. We certainly can't condone them. And now, with the United States, it seems, looking to overthrow the government of Russia and fighting Russia in this proxy war to every last drop of Ukrainian blood, what do you see the dangers are of escalation, even to the point of nuclear arms?
Well, there is a real danger of nuclear war. Unfortunately, Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons, and indeed there are NATO countries surrounding Russia. The U.S. has a military base 100 miles from the Russian border in Poland, a new base about to open this year, which likely has nuclear weapons. So the U.S. and other NATO countries are playing with fire. And the reason that Russia is so intent on Ukraine not becoming a member of NATO, because when the Soviet Union was breaking up, the U.S. government promise that former Soviet bloc countries and Warsaw Pact countries would not become members of NATO. Ukraine is right on the Russian border, and if Ukraine was a member of NATO, then under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, the founding document of NATO, all NATO countries would have to use military force to defend Ukraine, which means that we would already be in a hot war with U.S. troops and other NATO country troops in Russia and possibly even a nuclear war. So it's very, very dangerous and just adding fuel to the fire. The United States and other NATO countries should be pursuing a diplomatic solution and should be working hard to broker that. But unfortunately, they're spending more time arming Ukraine to the teeth. And of course, U.S. defense contractors are getting rich off of it.
Thank you very much, Marjorie Cohn, for being with us on Law and Disorder. This is about the most important thing that's going on in the world, and we pledge to our listeners that we'll continue coverage of this war. Thank you again, Marjorie. We really appreciate your preparation and the fine way that you've articulated the situation here. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The technology exists to halt and reverse the ongoing catastrophe of climate change. What is lacking is the political will to do so. It is legal in the United States to put millions of tons of poison into the air, but it is illegal to disrupt this ecocide. Our courts and Congress defend this ecocide. What is to be done? In 2016, four people, known as the Valve Turners, shut down four pipelines in the states of Washington, Montana, Minnesota, and North Dakota. They were arrested and tried. How did the Valve Turners defend themselves? They mounted the defense of necessity. The necessity defense is the legal concept that a person can commit a minor crime in order to prevent a larger one. In this case, the Valve Turners admitted to trespass on oil pipeline company property in order to prevent their ongoing contribution to the crisis of climate change. We speak today with attorney Ted Hamilton, author of the just-published book Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. Bill McKibbins described Ted Hamilton's book as a, quote, sweeping account of how the legal system enables the ongoing destruction of the planet, end quote. Ted Hamilton is a climate movement lawyer, writer, and literary scholar. After law school, he co-founded the Climate Defense Project, which provides legal assistance to climate justice activists, including the Valve Turners. He lives in Worcester, Massachusetts. Ted Hamilton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Ted, tell us just how bad is the climate crisis, and how long do we have to drastically change fossil law?
So the fossil law system has been in place for a long time. We don't have much time to replace it because the climate crisis is very, very serious. It's ongoing. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. It's going to continue to get worse the longer we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. You can look at scientific reports about how long we have to do that, whether it's stop extracting by 2030 or be net zero by 2050. But I think the most important point is that we're already in the middle of this crisis, and it's fundamentally a justice question because this is being done with full consciousness of the crisis to people who have not very seriously contributed to the problem. So that crisis of justice already exists, which means we've got to start dismantling fossil law now. And rather than identifying a deadline or an endpoint, I think we need to understand that this is already bad. It's already around us, and we've got to do this work as quickly as we possibly can.
Yeah, you know, Ted Hamilton, I just came across a report, which I'd hoped to have in front of me as we were talking today, by a number of world scientists who work on the climate question, saying that of the kind of 12 generally accepted quote-unquote tipping points we have talked about over the decades now, at least 9 of them have been passed already. So you're quite right to be crying the alarm on this. But I also wonder, and if you could tell our audience, how and why you got involved with these wonderful four folks in the Valve Turners.
I got involved with their case just shortly out of law school. I'd known some of the Valve Turners through climate activism while I was a law student in the Boston area. And I started a nonprofit with two fellow law students as soon as we graduated, Alex Markhart and Kelsey Skaggs. And what we wanted to do was defend climate activists and use our law licenses to try to dismantle fossil law and put forward some new theories for achieving climate justice. And very shortly after we started that organization, the Valve Turners took this action, this courageous action. And so we were already in touch with some of them, and they called us up and asked us to be a part of their legal team. So really in the days and weeks immediately following what they did in October 2016, ourselves with Climate Defense Project, along with Civil Liberties Defense Center and Lauren Regan, and another group of lawyers, got a legal team assembled on the fly, and we basically hit the ground running to try to advance their direct action into courtroom legal activism.
Ted, every government in the world has acknowledged that the tar sands oil that's coming down from Canada, this filthy oil, must be eliminated as quickly as possible. So how do you understand and appreciate the Valve Turners' actions?
Well, as we mentioned at the top, there's scientific consensus that things like tar sands oil can no longer be used. We're already past the point where it makes any sense at all to be pumping these fuels into the atmosphere. Tar sands oil is particularly polluting. It's particularly bad for the atmosphere. So we have that knowledge, and yet governments and corporations continue to put this stuff into the air. They fail to do anything about preventing this type of pollution. And in the absence of those powers taking responsibility and doing something, our only option is for activists and regular people to take this action. So we know what needs to be done. Nobody's doing it. I think it's pretty simple to see that we need people like the Valve Turners to do it themselves.
Yeah, Ted Hamilton, I don't practice law any longer, but I'm an attorney by training and education and what have you. And I was very impressed with the defense here that was put together. Why did you and the Valve Turners argue that it was necessary, not simply, you know, useful or strategic, but necessary for them to take matters into their own hands as I did? A necessity defense, if you will.
So this necessity defense has existed for a long time. It's not always used in political context. It's the idea that the legal system, laws, can't accurately predict any type of situation where somebody is going to need to act in the public good. And so we have to have a mechanism to allow people to violate the letter of the law in order to do something that benefits society. We're standing on the shoulders of a lot of great legal giants here who have developed this defense for political defendants, especially in the 1970s and 1980s. It had started to be used in the climate justice movement towards the end of the 2000s, early 2010s, so it was kind of out there in the air. These Valve Turners were very savvy about legal activism. They knew this was a potential option. And again, them looking at the tar sands problem, they knew that somebody needed to directly intervene, not only to try to actually shut off tar sands emissions, they actually shut off those pipelines that day, but to inspire and grow a movement to take this kind of direct action as well. If you study social history, American history, you know that often the government is not going to be pushed to do something in the interest of the people unless the people take the first step. So that was their theory of change. That's why it was necessary on multiple levels. And what we decided to do was to argue that there were no good legal alternatives to this. There was no government action that they could possibly pursue to turn off these pipelines. facing such a great hazard as the use of tar sands oil in a climate catastrophe, going on to corporate property to shut off these pipelines. And they did do it in a very safe manner, as testimony at trial revealed, no risk of a spill. They did everything the way the company would have done it to shut off these valves themselves. Doing that and trespassing is a really very minor harm compared to the drastic harm that was still ongoing in the absence of such action. So that's how they argued that this was necessary for them to do it, and it fit quite nicely within the common law of necessity, the necessity defense that other activists have used in the past to justify this kind of direct action when the government isn't doing anything.
We're talking with attorney Ted Hamilton, who just out of law school formed the Climate Defense Project, and they did some real good. We're going to get into how they won one of their cases. But I wanted to remind listeners that Ted is the author of the just-published book Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's a brilliant book, just beautifully written. Or Books, that's O-R, Or Books, orbooks.com, put it out. And I would recommend anybody that really wants to understand what we can do to try to tackle this crisis should get this book, Beyond Fossil Law, by Ted Hamilton. In one of the trials, the judiciary recognized the climate necessity defense. To what extent was this successful, and can this be used going forward?
So maybe it's important to look at all four different trials that happened over the course of the Valve Turners' encounter with the legal system. Their actions took place in four different states. Initially, when the lawyers and the defendants tried to offer climate necessity defense, the first kind of reactions we got from judges were that this was an absurd theory. There's always something else you can do besides civil disobedience to address a problem like this. Go sign another petition, lobby Congress. You got plenty of time. We even had a judge in Washington State say from the bench that climate change is a matter of great controversy. A lot of people think it's not real. And he wasn't going to host the Scopes monkey trial of global warming. That wasn't within his purview. And we got the state appellate court and then ultimately the state Supreme Court to allow that theory of climate necessity to go forward. Interestingly, what happened there, and this might be of interest to practicing attorneys out there, once we got judicial approval of this necessity defense, the judge actually found, before that whole defense theory was put forward, that the state couldn't even support its criminal charges. They were arguing that the defendants had damaged the pipeline, and they never did that. And so those charges were tossed out. Later in Washington, we appealed what that first trial judge had said about the controversial nature of global warming. And as we appealed up to the appellate court there, we also got a judicial recognition of the climate necessity defense. Now we've got a situation in Washington and Minnesota where high courts have put a stamp of approval on the theory. And that has now been picked up by and used by other activists beyond the Valve Turners. We've seen a successful case in Oregon. We've seen a case in Washington proceed under this theory. Just a few weeks ago in Pennsylvania, a group of activists successfully used the climate necessity defense. So within a few short years, and this is what I describe in the book, we went from a judicial approach to this theory as being kind of absurd and out there to now being written into the law, at least in a couple of states. We can start to cite that. People can start to use that in different states. And what we hope to see is kind of a propagation of this theory that can be used by defendants. We're not saying it's always going to be successful, but we've at least broken that wall that allows people to start arguing it and build a body of law from which, you know, to go forward and make this theory, make this argument around other types of civil disobedience.
And let me tell you, audience, I don't know if you're not a lawyer, perhaps you can't fully appreciate not only the brilliance of bringing this in the first place, but the victory that has been achieved and what that might mean going forward for the efforts to try to halt and reverse, if possible, climate change. This is a profound benefit to the movement around climate change, what you're listening to.
I think what the courts and the law hate is that a jury would be able to decide something against a corporation. And I think that they hate the fact that people know, a lot of people out there know, that something's wrong with the climate. And to be able to bring this evidence to a jury and to be able to have a jury do something that's going to affect a corporation is a tremendous breakthrough.
It really is. That poor judge who wants to talk about the controversy about climate change is way behind the majority of people now in this country, thankfully. But I wonder, Ted, speaking of the courts and speaking of the legal system, what do we need to know to fully understand the legal system's contribution to the rise of carbon emissions and the suffering and injustices that these emissions produce? Talk to us a bit about that.
One way to think about this is that there is a legal infrastructure that's parallel to the physical infrastructure of the fossil fuel system. So we've got pipelines and refineries and oil wells all around us. There's also a lot of legal rules, regulations, principles that support the continued use of fossil fuels. That ranges from direct government support of the industry. We still subsidize the extraction and use of fossil fuels in the United States. We lease fossil fuel extraction on federal land, so it's directly promoted by a whole suite of legal policies. But then we've also got a gigantic apparatus that protects the fossil fuel industry from any type of attack or any type of attempt to prevent them from damaging the world's atmosphere. So whether those are private property rights that protect their profits, protect their use of fossil fuel facilities, or whether that's various rules of process and standing. We can get into some detail on those points if you like, but there are a whole bunch of ideas and concepts baked into our legal system that make it extremely difficult to argue that what they're doing is wrong or what they're doing is illegal. And just to take an example, Chief Justice Roberts in Massachusetts versus EPA, which is a major climate change case in 2007. He was in the dissent there. He didn't win, but he argued that climate change is such a global problem, its effects last for so many decades and centuries, that it's really not appropriate for a U.S. federal court to allow anyone to argue that they've been harmed by this, that their harm is distinct from anyone else's, or that there's really any defendant who should be responsible. It's something we're all involved in, is kind of the idea. Now, Justice Roberts' philosophy is probably more in the ascendance with the arch-conservative Supreme Court supermajority, and I think that kind of indicates the kind of philosophy and approach to this problem that really sees interference with the fossil fuel system as illegitimate.
Speaking about, indeed, how the corporations and governments are building new apparatuses of legal control and such, certainly, they're fighting back to the kinds of decisions you won with the valve turners. But we lose sight of how indigenous communities in particular are bearing the brunt very often of this state violence. Talk to us a bit about that. And isn't that somewhat of an answer to what Roberts was arguing as well?
So this is a really important point, and I think it reveals a couple of things for us. Number one, that the fossil fuel system is deeply implicated with colonialism and with how this country was settled, with settler colonialism. This is not something from the history books. We're still seeing fossil fuel companies, with the aid of the government, invading indigenous territory in order to extract these fossil fuels. Another thing that this continued practice of invasion and violation of indigenous rights, the other thing that reveals is that part of fossil law, part of the legal apparatus that promotes the use of fossil fuels, is the use of the criminal legal system, the use of police and prosecutors to suppress dissent and prevent people from interfering with this system. And so at places like Standing Rock or the fight over the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota, where the Ojibwe people are located, you see the government, in conjunction with corporations, going onto these lands and asserting the property rights of corporations to build pipelines and extract oil from those areas, regardless of the risk. There's a lot of legal issues involved there. I mean, these are violations of treaty rights. They're violations of environmental protections and cultural protections. but we really can't totally understand how the government actually works with corporations without understanding that those are often the focal points, the front lines of the climate justice fight, because those are some of the last remaining places we can find new fossil fuels. If we flip that around, we can also see indigenous communities acting as a vanguard for climate justice, acting as a vanguard for legal fights against the fossil fuel system. And they've done a lot of the most important work in articulating different sorts of legal ideas, different sorts of legal defenses to push back on fossil law.
We're speaking with Ted Hamilton, who's written the just-published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's published by OR Books. That's orbooks.com. And Ted, I want to tell you, I thought that the chapter where you write about what they've done on indigenous land and what they've done to these people and how the indigenous people have fought back was one of the most beautifully written chapters in your book. And I congratulate you on that. But I wanted to ask you, Ted, what concepts of environmental rights and stewardship hold the promise of abolishing fossil law? Talk about the development of public trust doctrine and the rights of nature as climate law of the future, please.
Public trust doctrine and rights of nature are both good examples of what we might think of as climate justice law, what might replace fossil law. They are ideas that would not only give us really good environmental outcomes, but also could help us to shift our thinking about the relationship between people and their environment and the need for the legal system to take a much more comprehensive view of how we affect biodiversity, affect other species, and the obligations that we hold for future generations. All of which, those ideas, are pretty hard for our currently existing legal system to acknowledge, let alone address in any substantive way. So the public trust doctrine, again, a pretty ancient legal idea dating back to the Byzantine Empire, at least, the notion that a sovereign, a government, has a responsibility to protect natural resources. Things like water, things like the air, should be held in common for the use of everyone today and everybody in the future. Basically, the public trust doctrine is the reason why nobody can buy the Mississippi River, or you can't buy Lake Michigan. We have this deep-seated assumption that those things are for the public use, and they shouldn't be degraded for private interest. So some intelligent and crafty advocates and lawyers have started seeing how this relates to the climate crisis and saying, maybe the atmosphere, maybe bodies of water, all of these different elements of the environment are being affected by the profit-making activities of the fossil fuel industry. Let's assert the government's responsibility to protect those resources and force them to implement policies and plans that would prevent private corporations from degrading them because they belong to all of us. Now, related to that, but I would say maybe a little bit even more ambitious or a more foundational critique of fossil law is involved with rights of nature. That is essentially the idea that we should grant legal subjectivity, legal personhood, legal rights to non-humans, whether that's other mammalian species, or that could be ecosystems, that could be mountains, it could be rivers. Why not give them legal standing, given that they're so important to our society, and we have an ethical sense that they deserve to thrive in their own right? So there's a lot of ways people have thought about how to construct such a system, give human spokespersons the right to talk about the interests of nature. And one thing I really want to emphasize here, and as I hope I describe accurately in the book, is that rights of nature is an idea that's really coming from other countries. It's not most prominent in the United States. Indigenous communities are leading the fight for rights of nature, and in particular in Latin America, in countries like Ecuador and Bolivia, they've already constitutionalized or legislated rights of nature, and we're at the early phases, but we're already starting to see again how nature rights can give us better environmental protection, but can also give us a new and better sense of legal obligation and how we think about our relationship to non-humans and to future generations.
7 years ago, I edited a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Michael Ratner, one of the founders of Law and Disorder, contributed a chapter. And his chapter was entitled, What I Would Do If I Was the Attorney General. And one of the things he said he would do was that he would recognize the rights of nature in the same way that Ecuador and Bolivia did. So that was the first time that I got an inkling of what it meant to have the rights of nature. And I was so very pleased to see that in your book, Beyond Fossil Law, that you write about that too, the rights of nature, a really profound and revolutionary concept.
Yeah, it is. And it's another example of why there is a growing intelligent thought about climate change, and why, in fact, there are actually some things that are being done that are helpful and right. And yet, not to throw a wet blanket on all of this, the fact remains that every year over the past number of years, the amount of greenhouse gases, methane gases that are being released into the atmosphere that are the culprit here because of human activity, get higher as opposed to lower, despite the fact that we know now more about what we should be doing and, more importantly, perhaps what we shouldn't be doing. And, of course, we know that when it comes to the property interest of corporations, they generally trump the health concerns of future generations and so forth. I guess my question, Ted, is so long as we have these large capitalist corporations who win in court more often than they lose, who despite what little measures may be taken, they continue to pollute the atmosphere more every year as a collective than the year before, can we hope to ever actually achieve what we need to achieve with respect to climate change, so long as those large capitalist corporations are allowed to function as they do today?
So I seriously doubt that we would ever design a market system with large multinational corporations that would not be inclined to continue profiting off of fossil fuels. So I do think we need to really remove them as the chief actors who control our environmental destiny. And we can look at this, again, at a few different levels. Most basically, fossil fuel industry has structural control of Congress. Those aren't my words. Those are actually the words of Brian Schatz, a senator from Hawaii. They actually control our policy around climate change. But more deeply, even a system like environmental law in the United States, which has done a lot of good work in terms of conservation and environmental health, it essentially exists as a way to mitigate the impact of corporations on the environment, but not to fundamentally challenge how they operate. And again, there's just a foundational manner in which these corporations need to continue seeking cheap energy sources in order to ramp up production and keep producing profits. So long as that's the way we're designing our interaction with the environment, I don't think there's much hope for preventing climate catastrophe. So one of the tasks for legal activists and legal actors is not only to ramp up environmental protection, but to change the rules of the game so that it becomes illegal to conduct that sort of activity rather than legal, but maybe with some regulations or limits on how severe the outcomes might be.
Well, Ted Hamilton, unfortunately, we've come down to the end of our allotted time here. I wanted to remind our listeners that you've written the just published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's a beautifully written book, an important book, and I urge people to go out and get it. You can get it from OR Books, ORbooks.com. Ted, before we have to say goodbye, if listeners want to get active, what might they do? And secondly, how can listeners stay in touch with you and your organization?
I think everybody should go out and try to join their local climate justice groups. We need more people getting out into the streets and taking the kind of action that the valve turners did, getting directly involved in preventing the extraction use of fossil fuels. Find your local group. Look at umbrella organizations like the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance that are trying to connect people across continents and national boundaries. And then my organization, Climate Defense Project, you can check us out at climatedefenseproject.org. You can contact us, and we've got some great resources for activists on our website as well.
Well, Ted Hamilton, I mean, it's just been a pleasure to have you with us today. I've learned a lot. I suspect our audience has as well, and we really thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a fantastic show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very...
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
But my key point is this, that actually it is possible to reimagine capitalism. It is possible to fix its flaws. It is not a perfect system. But capitalism and markets operate on the idea that you need to have a plurality of ideas and competition. You need to have checks and balances. Things move in cycles. And right now, we need to fix capitalism.
That's Jillian Tett, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jillian Tett and Yanis Varoufakis on Can Capitalism Be Fixed? Capitalism's origins, several centuries ago, can be traced to the expropriation of the commons and its transformation into private property. Since those hoary beginnings, it has evolved into an economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production and its operation for profit. In the last 40 years or so, capitalism has evolved into its neoliberal phase, characterized by deregulation, punishing bubbles, economic crises, and jaw-dropping income and wealth inequality. The system's egregious excesses are sometimes addressed by lawmakers who serve up temporary bromides to placate the restless many. But they're just tinkering around the edges, making cosmetic changes. The system is fundamentally the same. There is no alternative, we are told. Why isn't there? To talk about whether capitalism can be fixed are Jillian Tett and Yanis Varoufakis. Jillian Tett is an award-winning journalist at the Financial Times, where she is chair of the editorial board and U.S. editor-at-large. Yanis Varoufakis is a member of the Greek parliament. He served as finance minister of Greece in 2015. He's founder of Mera 25, a progressive Greek political party. The debate was held at Union Chapel in London, United Kingdom, and moderated by Anne McElvoy. We begin with Yanis Varoufakis.
Now, the problem with these boys' games, you know, Oxford Union debates, is that they force upon us a dichotomy. Either you're in favor of emotion or against emotion, which is fun, but not very helpful. So allow me to answer the question in my own way. I don't think it's an interesting question, whether we should fix capitalism. Because capitalism, and this is something that I have managed to convince myself of in the last year or so. 2021 is a little bit like the 1790s, when Adam Smith was writing The Wealth of Nations. In the sense that the world was feudal, but there were small pockets of capitalism that were emerging that Adam Smith managed to cotton onto. You know, Glasgow University, it was happening just below him, in the Clyde Valley, he could see it. But it was tiny, it was a speck of capitalist dust